We are speaking with Lorelei Kelly. She is Senior Associate and Project Director of the Security for a New Century program at the Henry L. Stimson Center. Lorelei, thanks for spending time with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
If you could begin, tell us, what is the Security for a New Century program?
Security for a New Century program is a project that I started in the late 90s with three members of Congress to bring some new, fresh ideas and voices into Congress, and in this case, the House of Representatives, to catch some of the issues that were falling between the cracks of the traditional committee system and to really focus on some of the most progressive things that were happening in U.S. foreign policy for which there is no internal venue in Congress. Since that time, we've expanded to the Senate, and so now we run this program both in the House and the Senate, bringing these new voices into Capitol Hill.
So how is it that these ideas that you're trying to bring in there, that there wouldn't have been an internal venue for them?
Well, part of it, I mean, there's a couple of ways to answer that. Part of it is just that our institutions of government, especially Congress, are really trapped in the Cold War. The committee system is not set up to deal with these, I don't know, for lack of a better term, interdisciplinary kinds of problems we're facing today, like global health, environmental scarcity, post-conflict reconstruction, nation building. These kinds of things don't fit neatly into boxes. And so a lot of items simply get missed. That, on top of the fact that there's no natural feedback loop for our own foreign policy professionals, like our Army or our State Department, inside Congress, except from the very orchestrated and highly, you know, high-stakes committee hearing system. So we found this vast opportunity underneath the committee system to start convening purely educational and bipartisan issue forums. Now, the reason that there was such an opening is because part of the contract with America in 1995 was to eliminate a lot of the internal substantive voices and staff and bipartisan public interest resources inside Congress. And that was done for a number of reasons, which is an entirely different conversation, partly about power, partly about, you know, efficiency. But the effect is what I like to semi-jokingly call the lobotomy of Congress, which happened in the mid-90s, and we're really suffering from it still today.
So you're kind of going in and reconnecting those synapses for people?
We do the best we can, and I could not imagine us being able to do this very well without things like the internet. What we do is we organize inside Congress using the venues of Congress itself. For example, I'll bring in somebody who has just come back from the provisional reconstruction teams in Afghanistan, who was the liaison between the local tribes and the health clinic and the military and the Special Operations Command, and have them tell us from a ground truth perspective what policies were working and what policies could use some real improvement. And this is the kind of ground truth information that a lot of Hill staff don't have access to. That's for a lot of reasons, too. But one of the things that I've noticed, having been on Capitol Hill for the last 7 years, is that if our governing institutions don't create the staff, positions, and interest in pure public interest common goods like peacekeeping, then there's not any necessary way that's going to happen. On the other hand, you have the vacuum filled by commercial interests who have very direct, discrete needs and outcomes in mind when they come talk about things like defense and foreign policy. And by this, I mean the defense industry.
So it seems to me that the U.S. doesn't seem particularly interested from a national standpoint in the concept of diplomacy anymore. It seems that we've been gutting that system probably for close to my entire lifetime. So is that an issue that your organization is dealing with?
We definitely do everything we can to bolster the idea of balance in our foreign and security policy. And you can talk to anybody from the DOD to a career foreign service officer who'll tell you that we simply have let our diplomacy corps languish and atrophy over the last 30 years, as you said. I remember in the mid-90s when I moved to Washington, D.C., that the only way I could contact friends at the State Department was through an outside email address like Yahoo or Hotmail, because their internal infrastructure for electronic communications was so dismal. Now, I have a lot of friends who are officers, too, and I've talked to a number of them as they've come back from being deployed. And they say, overall, that it's apparent that we've over-militarized our policy in general and that we're going to have to do something to bring balance back. And this is reflective of military doctrine itself, which posits that military really should only be used as a fourth of, as an option of last resort. And we simply don't do that anymore. We use the military as an option of first resort to solve all kinds of problems for us. And I think that this challenge lies squarely in the lap of our civilian leadership. Certainly, we have a president right now who has a penchant for dominance and probably feels more comfortable using the military freely than others, but this started in the 90s, so we've had this problem for quite a while. And again, there's a whole conversation about why this happens. The military is very capable, and it's basically a human resources organization that continually practices to be ready. What if we had a concept of diplomatic dominance like we do military dominance? Then we would really be prepared for the kind of things we're seeing today.
So how do we get to that point where we have a strong diplomatic corps and you know, the resources necessary to deal with the kind of conflicts that are coming up in the world?
Well, one of the problems with Congress is that the direct feedback loop and constituency for military types of answers, as in hardware programs, are very directly related to constituencies and vast, very influential political constituencies. I'm sitting here in Washington State, where Boeing for years has, you know, read the Riot Act to any member of Congress who strayed from its list of priorities. Issues like non-hardware defense issues, essentially what I call them, human resource security issues, like more people for the Army, like health and transnational criminal networks, things like environmental scarcity. These kinds of issues are long-term and diffuse, and they don't have a direct political constituency that makes noise, that has a long-term relationship, and that calls attention to themselves during the budget season in Congress. The book that we wrote, Policy Matters, Educating Congress on Peace and Security, tries to address this. We make the case that in a post-9/11 world, the public and citizens who are interested and engaged need to develop a much more sophisticated political constituency for what I'm calling non-hardware defense issues or human resource type security issues. And I don't like this term, but in academia it's commonly called soft security. Soft security versus hard security. Hard security is the stuff at the pointy end of the spear. That's important too, but we've already proved that we can do that really well. We need to prove that we can do the other stuff really well, and that is going to take a major and dramatic reallocation of resources.
So maybe we could touch on some of the examples that you bring out in your book, Policy Matters. What could you recommend to listeners into how they can get Congress and their elected officials to start heading in the direction of a strong diplomatic corps?
One of the things that I think is really important today, and this wouldn't have been possible 5 years ago, is for, say, a peace group or the Quakers to get together with the National Guard and Reserve officers who've just come back from Iraq or Afghanistan and have a real conversation with them. I'll tell you, I promise you, that you'll have way more in common than you think that you do. And one of the things that we're doing at the Stimson Center across the country right now is to do this very convening of civilians and the military. Something I've noticed over the last 7 years of being in Congress is that there's been a real hangover from Vietnam, which drew out in the post-Cold War era, where you have sort of blind ignorance on the left of the military and blind worship on the right. And what's falling between the cracks of those sort of extreme and completely inadequate perspectives is the military itself. We've gotten to the point now where we've started to privatize a lot of parts of the military that's very wounding to a military's professional ethic. What I've noticed, though, is there's really not a lot of voices on Capitol Hill that can speak with substance and background and confidence on this. And this is something that really needs to be bolstered, I think, in a public conversation as well. So that's one of these sort of non-traditional alliances I'm encouraging people to go out and make and simply figure out a way to convene. and get some of the ground truth perspective on what's actually happening in the world and what we need to do to change it. Now, Washington State overall has a really pretty good congressional delegation, I must say. But one of the things that you notice on the Hill is that it's a very time-constrained environment. And so those issues that make the most noise or are the squeakiest wheel get the attention first. And something has to be user-friendly and also made clear to members about why they should act on something. There's poll results that show that Americans, by vast majority, something like 70%, agree that the United States needs to participate actively in a progressive and cooperative way in the world. And so we wonder then, how do we end up with leadership that seems at times so short-sighted and reactionary? Well, part of that is because that support, that interest, is what's called permissive and not demanding. As American citizens, we need to sit back and say, okay, how do we make that support demanding and not just passive? And that's really the key to getting results in a place like Congress or any legislature for that matter, is to develop that kind of long-term trusted relationship with elected leaders who have control over resources. And it's not rocket science. I tell folks who are involved in the peace movement or who are completely intimidated by security issues, it's back down to basics these days. I mean, we're talking about body armor for our soldiers. We're talking about flu vaccine. We're talking about some real basic backyard issues that have links to foreign policy and security today. In 1985, it was rocket science. It's not anymore.
Clarify for me then what you would see as a realistic policy that citizens could undertake. For instance, there's been a call out for after the elections that there's going to be demonstrations across the U.S., regardless of who is elected, for trying to influence our policy in Iraq. Do you see demonstrations like that as being an effective tool or an ineffective tool?
Well, I've done my share of demonstrations. I've been chained to fences. I've spent the night on outside of nuclear bases in England in the 80s. And I think that there is a place for active, visible demonstration. However, as somebody who works sort of on the left side of politics in a very polarized situation, what I find really lacking are the next steps. You know, I understand the frustration of the anti-globalization movement. However, there's a real limit to what you can do if you're outside the process, if you're always just chaining yourself to fences or always just banging your head against the wall. I remember when I was in my mid-20s, I sat down and I said, okay, I love hanging out with the Greens. I love going to these forest protests, but I need a graduate degree. And what I call, I laundered myself through the academic system. I went to Stanford. I got a degree. I got a couple suits. I learned how to talk the talk, and I got inside the system. And I tell you, if you can do that, if you can figure out a pathway inside the system, you, as a kind of creative activist type, who plays by most of the rules, but not by all of them, can do so much. You can influence so much. It's truly amazing. Because you're going to come up with different kinds of ideas than anybody else. And if you keep them in a positive problem-solving framework, people will respond. And I tell you, this project we started on Capitol Hill, I thought it could be dead in 6 weeks because, for example, maybe no Republicans would show up because I was running it on the staff of a liberal Democrat. That wasn't true at all. We have the only 50-50 participation record inside Congress to this day, and it's still the only bipartisan venue left in Congress. And that really speaks very well to positive problem solving.
Again, do you address these issues and techniques in your book, Policy Matters?
Well, in Policy Matters, we really give away all the secrets. And, of course, our focus is Congress and Washington, D.C., because that's what we know best. But one of the things we found over and over again as we brought these new voices up to Capitol Hill and shared them with both Democrats and Republicans is that vast appetite for credible knowledge from people who wouldn't otherwise have an opportunity to come up and inform their elected leaders about what was going on. So, yes, this is very much what we do up on Capitol Hill. And the Policy Matters Guide talks about everything from how do you frame an issue, and framing, as we know from reading magazines and the newspaper lately, has gotten a lot more attention about long-term success. You have to frame an issue in a sophisticated way and then adhere to a consistent set of principles, values, and talking points as you push an agenda along. So we talk about framing. How do you get out of the old kinds of hawks versus doves, crippling frameworks for new ideas? How do you make an appointment, and what do you take to a district meeting? How do you get a room on Capitol Hill if you happen to go there? What is the kind of information? What are red button issues, or third rails, in other words? If you're dealing with a third rail issue and you still want to talk about it, and by this I mean something like Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or even the International Criminal Court, or even Kyoto until recently, the clean air and the Kyoto protocols about global warming, how do you bring them up indirectly so that it's safe for the member to talk about it? What is political capital? How do you translate values into action? All of those kinds of things are addressed.
And your book, Policy Matters, is available both in standard paper format as well as on the web?
Yes, in fact, we're giving it away online. I'm not supposed to advertise this far and wide, but I do because I really want people to use it. You can download the whole thing on PDF format at www.stimson.org. And it's still on the homepage of the website. If for some reason it's not there, go into the Security for a New Century link, and you'll find it there or under publications. But you can peruse as much as you want online, or you can download the chapters most useful for you. Or if you really want the shiny blue copy, you can send us a note, and we'll put one in the mail for you for $10.
And is it your feeling that the ideas and techniques that are in your book are enough for citizens to be able to overcome the 25,000, 30,000 lobbyists in D.C. that are pushing their own agenda?
Actually, I do, because I've worked in a Hill office long enough to know that in a democracy, if it's empowered, really, the political voters and constituents back at the home base can rule the agenda. And what we see is a real lack of organization at that level. And I tell you, for people who are interested in progressive politics these days, what we really need to do is take back the idea of public interest and what that means. And who's your lobby for public interest? Well, it's the public. And we've gotten so far into the extremes of political rhetoric these days. And from my position, I think that something the right wing has done very effectively is it's made the center the left. And so we're skewed off to the right now. And we're still going along on this highly conservative ideological plank of, you know, small government, less taxes, strong defense, without really sitting down and seeing that that's not working very well for us anymore. So given that we're going off the cliff in that direction, how can we create some balanced dialogues? And again, I stress this is not partisan and it's not anti-military. It's something new and different. And to those who make the effort now to organize voices, to listen, to come up with problem-solving frameworks, I really feel that those are the folks that are going to have a great deal of influence from now into the foreseeable future. And to the extent that those folks can also create a political relationships in the hallways of power, those people will amplify the message. And so a lot of it now is this organic process of how we're going to reframe how we talk about the U.S. relationship with the world and how we're going to move forward in that. And I might mention this other resource, a project I've been part of called U.S. in the World. It's online at www.usintheworld.org, which offers a communication strategy for talking about these issues. And it's also available completely online, and it has a lot of helpful videos, it has a lot of explanations. But what they've tried to do is put lots of diverse issue interests, like, for example, nuclear nonproliferation and environment and energy. If you want to talk about those issues, how do you place them in a larger, consistent framework so that we can always go back and refer to values and big picture ideas and long-term plans while we talk about the diverse and complex issues that we're facing today?
Do you potentially see both of these resources as being applicable to organizations beyond just the Congress and Senate?
Oh, I definitely do. In fact, I'm hoping that people will take our book and write versions of it for local community situations. I was at a conference all day yesterday for folks who teach international education here in the state of Washington, and I was telling them that since this is a relatively small and nascent movement here in this state, wouldn't it be great if they would document their lessons learned, document their process of organizing and the messages they've used to create a coalition, and, for example, adopt the state of Idaho so they could do the same thing, or export that, those lessons learned. Those are really the kind of nuts and bolts examples that probably, I certainly took for granted that everybody knew this before we sat down and wrote this book, but the response we've been getting from people, very often it's the most basic connect the dots kind of information that people don't have, and it puts them into a corner where they can't get out of. And I think we got to keep in mind that you can't make assumptions that folks know how to do some of the most basic organizing, and so to help people do that at a local level is what I hope happens with our book, that people see it as a model, an example, how we've organized it, how we've really explained the very nuts and bolts of the operation, and that can occur here as well.
I think a lot of people would agree, regardless of who wins the election, that our government is not really representing the people anymore. Its corporations have gotten the upper hand. What ideally would you recommend to people that they could do in the next couple months to take back our government?
Well, not to be completely overly obvious, I think we need a lot of shifts in government at the top level, at the very top level, in fact. 4 years ago, even though I didn't vote for President Bush, I had great hopes that he would come in and do some things that were transformative for government. I think, as I mentioned earlier, I thought I would stop dragging my jaw off the kitchen floor every morning about 2 years ago, but still I'm shocked and appalled at a lot of the, frankly, and I use this word very carefully, anti-democratic behavior that's being perpetuated at the top levels of the Republican Party. I grew up in a family with Republicans. I grew up in a family with Democrats. It's never been a really big deal because in the end of the day, everyone was interested in good government and society moving forward and fairness and sharing and things like community values. I think that we're in a situation now, and especially I see this a lot on Capitol Hill, probably more in the House than in the Senate, where we've fallen into this sort of corporatism or sort of real right-wing socialism where you have access purchased by those who can provide the most direct immediate benefits, and you have what I call the goon squads at the top of the party operations that will make phone calls that threaten people if they example hire Democrats. You have a real sickness inside the process itself where they are violating the spirit of the laws repeatedly, doing things like locking the minority out of meetings when it's about writing the final legislation, holding votes open after the time limit so that the outcome is changed. These are the kind of things maybe we expected to see in 1985 coming out of South America. This is not something you expect to see in Washington, D.C. And so in my view, and I tell my Republican friends this, take your party back. Take it back before it's too late and support the moderate Republicans out there. Support them. And I mean, one thing that I think is frightening after the election is if we remain this bitter and divided population, this red and blue states. You know, the red and blue states idea, that's an artifice. It's a political artifice that helps people stay in power because polarization helps the extremes. And that's not what most of us want. That's just the truth. I know it's a nice soundbite. It looks great on graphics. But I'm from a very conservative part of a marginally blue state, that's northern New Mexico, and I go home and I find things to talk about in common with my friends and neighbors and relatives. I know that it's possible, and it's going to take citizens at the individual level insisting that it just ain't so. We aren't a bitter and divided population. We're all in this together. We've got to deal with these security threats challenging us. We need to let go of the past. Unfortunately, politics really distorts policy. And something we've also seen repeatedly is that this White House chooses politics over policy every single time. And that is terribly damaging to your public service professionals. We're seeing that right now in Iraq, where it's really a matter of life and death for our soldiers. We're seeing that many times over, that they aren't considering policy common good outcomes if they get in the way of political power. That's something that every American should be concerned about.
Any final thoughts for our listeners?
What I would say is that democracy is a work in progress, and that there's plenty of open terrain right now of really going back to the basics and figuring out what it means to you to have an open and free society, the kind of trade-offs and compromises that need to be made to make sure that the public interest is served. And truly to understand that the public interest to be served requires the participation of the public, and that folks like me on the inside of the system really, really would love to hear more from people who are representing common good issues in a sophisticated enough way so that they make a difference in the halls of power. And yes, the competition is tough. Private industry has always had a role in government. I'm not complaining about that. What I'm complaining about is the real distortion and imbalance in that right now. If those are the only voices that we hear effectively, those are the voices that will get served. So I'm encouraging folks, and I'm not just plugging my book, although it is for free online, is to take a look at it, give us some feedback, and see if it fits to some of your local efforts to coalition build and reach out to those in power.
All right, and again, where can people find out more about your organization and your book?
The organization is the Henry L. Stimson Center. It's www.stimson.org. It's a think tank in Washington, D.C. It's nonpartisan, and we have a lot of good items on the website. The other item that I mentioned is U.S. in the World. That's on the web at usintheworld.org. That's the communication strategy information. And I'm available online, too, if anybody wants to send me an email, answer questions.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
We've just been talking with Lorelei Kelly. She is Senior Associate and Project Director of the Security for a New Century program at the Henry L. Stimson Center.